I'm Dream Queen. You're in the cab with me. Thanks for joining. You're in the book club with me and Icky Mac. Icky Mac, welcome.
Hello.
Again. So we're discussing A Knock at Midnight, inspiration from the great sermons of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me.
For sure. Fellow KMRD DJ, your show is on Friday nights, 9 to midnight.
That's right. So we are well not rested. I'm kidding.
Tell us a little bit about your show, because there's your show, and then also you are a gigging DJ artist, music artist. So tell us a little bit about how all of that works together and what your mission is.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Huh. So my show, typically for my radio show, you know, I have a much wider audience than my gigging profession. My radio show is very experimental, I would say. If I were to really tie it all into like what we're talking about now, I cast a wide net. You know, I try to play a little bit of everything so that you can hear it and be enticed to hear more. So it's a little bit hard to turn the radio down is really the goal. But at the same time, I also really try to bring in relevant information from what's going on in the world, what's happening. Mostly lately, it's been a little bit more solution oriented or based off of the alternative to the grief that we're really experiencing on the whole, because we don't want to lose hope. You know, we've got a reason for why we're doing this. And I would say if I had to sum it up, you know, my show is like that quote that I gave you from before, V for Vendetta, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the book by Alan Moore. It's also in the TV or the movie show. But what is it? A revolution without dancing is not a revolution worth having. I agree. You know, a lot of times we get caught up in, you know, how severe things are. And it weighs us down and it burdens us, you know, but we really have to remember what we are fighting for. You know, we're fighting for love. We're fighting for the dignity and the respect of all human beings. And a lot of the times that's really the joy that we find when we're, you know, sharing and, you know, a good common ground, you know, being with each other, you know, being the company that we keep, you know, and we forget that. And so I do a mix of those things. Sometimes my show can get pretty heavy, though. Mm-hmm. And but I'm always trying to keep the butts wiggling.
Can we say butts?
I don't think we can. Yeah. we'll just edit this out.
One T. Yes, the J word. The other J word. We talked about the J word of Jesus last week. And I'm talking now about the J word of joy, you know, so I appreciate you bringing that reminder to myself often, as we are dear friends, and also to your audience, is that it's important to remember that the reason we're even doing all this is to experience life from a place of joy.
That's right. And, you know, honestly, doing what I do brings me a lot of joy. Mm-hmm. I've been delving deep into turntablism. And for those of you who don't know, that's when you have two records spinning and you can do things like keep an infinite beat or you bring another song onto another song. And there's this, for me, there's this whole Zen quality to it where it really puts my mind at ease. Even though I've got all this math to do, you know, I got to turn the record three times back. I got to turn this record three times back. I got to flip back over to here. You know, there's a lot of things that have to happen that you have to be super conscious of. But as you allow yourself to just dissolve into it, you know, it's I find my mind just does it. And these things are just automated now. And my, you know, I don't have things that really, even though my body's focused on things, my mind just clears up. And I really like what that does for me.
Is there like a physical meditation? Will we call that, I don't know, some sort of chi or tai chi or, you know?
Yeah, I don't have the word for it.
Of turntablism?
Yeah, maybe we're inventing it.
Tune in next week, folks. We'll have it all laid out.
Well, you know, sometimes like when I'm out here digging, there's a certain rhythm to the digging that just keeps me going and I can just kind of get locked into it, you know, or certain jobs that I do, you know, kind of have that rhythmic purpose, where you just, you know, shovel in the ground, shovel over your shoulder, shovel in the ground, shovel over your shoulder. Mm-hmm. And you just kind of get lost in it sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it, you don't want to think about it, because if you do, you're just going to be like, why am I doing this? You know? My body hurts.
Right.
You know?
The rhythm.
Rhythm is life. I mean, honestly, if you look at it, all things require rhythm, mm-hmm. not just our music. You know, the rhythm of the oceans are critical to the evolution of this. The rhythm of the planet around the sun. Yeah, I'm sure that, like, on a level that we don't understand it, the way our solar system travels around its galactic center, mm-hmm. you know, probably is a big part of what keeps us alive. You know, we're in the Goldilocks zone, they say. And so, like, a little too far, and we're going to get fried by a supernova just a few billion light years away. But we're just in that right area, you know, and it's that rhythm, that dance that we do around things.
So, talking about rhythm, we have one main beatkeeper. It's our heart,
right? That's in your exactly chest. Right.
You know, that's the main beatkeeper. And, you know, talking about spirituality, especially the ancient traditions, paganism or whatever you want to call it, the first language was the drum beat, how we communicate with the universe through the beating of the drum. It's very fascinating. I'm not really set up to discuss it in depth today, but I've been doing some research into not hypnosis, but what brings us to the trance state, what brings us to that dream state in ritual, and how the drum is very present in most cultures with collective ritual, especially. You know, it's how you get into that trance zone real quick.
We should search for a book on it so that we can do that next.
It's really. I'm not going to shoot down that idea. You know, I think that it's a lot of what could go to in the first hour. So many of you know how to find me on Mixcloud. You'll be looking for me soon on YouTube. And so we're going to have a little bit more talk and less music in the second hour because of copyright issues online. But we're going to start putting these shows up on YouTube. But I'd really like to explore. I had a project called Dream State, and it was my idea because I'm a bass player, as you know, but many people out here might not know that. And very early on in my musical foray, I won't say career, my love of music is really playing with that idea of meditation and changing the vibration of the collective through meditation. And, you know, the om, the tonality, right. We know about tones and how it can affect the mind.
Right.
And it's said that the universe does have a sound.
That's right. I mean, NASA has come up with that even. There's recordings, and they do have tones, and they do. And actually, even all the planets, everything hums at different. And it's not just a theory. This is, you know, recorded things. I mean, the audio isn't quite what we would normally recognize, but yeah.
Yeah. So we are all connected through the vibration of the universe, the hum. Therefore, I think it's important that we find peace with each other so that we may be in harmony.
Yeah, maybe that is a lot of our violence that we have towards one another, is that we're at different octaves, not octaves, we're at different pitches, disharmonies. Different vibrations. Right? And it's really coalescing into like one vibration is maybe where we all get back together.
Or harmonious vibrations. Harmonious vibrations, nobody wants to hear everything, you know. We don't tone. All need to go the same note. But we love harmony, that's don't right. we?
Yeah.
That's why we call it peace and harmony. Mm-hmm. We're all bringing our different our different ways of being, because as Dr. King and some of the writings of the apostles remind us, that we are all blessed with different talents and gifts, and we are all children of the Most High and put here with our purpose to resonate with one another.
To resonate.
Not for the destruction of the planet and each other, but to vibrate in harmony.
I came for one reason and I left with another.
We were going to be all concise, y'all, about the book on point, you know, always trying to tighten up the production.
If we could just open up a window and throw all my notes out right now.
I do that every week.
Right.
Come on, just put it in a burn pile. Oh, boy. So we're discussing A Knock at Midnight, inspiration from the great sermons of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And before we get into the meat of the sermon, I want to bring the audience up to speed with those who do not have the book in their possession and may not have read it. I just want to set it up, okay? Thank you. No, I'm going to use this over here. Right. I appreciate it.
I got you.
Did a little write-up, and so we're going to try this out. So the introduction to this sermon, in the book, all of the sermons that are listed have introductions by people who've worked with the great Reverend Dr. King, other ministers, and people who have very prominent minds. So this sermon, the introduction, was written by Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian, who was a close friend and colleague of Dr. King. And I opened up a vast rabbit hole on C.T. Vivian, didn't really get to dive deep. But if you are curious about the works, just the tip of the iceberg, Vivian served on King's executive staff during the Civil Rights Movement. He also co-founded the Nashville Christian Leadership Conference, during which time he helped organize the first sit-ins in Nashville and the first Civil Rights March in 1961. King said Dr. Vivian was, quote, the greatest preacher to ever live. In his introduction to Paul's Letter to American Christians, that's this sermon today, Dr. Vivian refers to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as, quote, our 21st century prophet. On page 21 of A Knock at Midnight, inspiration from the great sermons of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. Vivian says, quote, very seldom have the poor of America had such an able spokesman to organize them. He could demand order beyond law and deliver truth to power on their behalf. He goes on to say that King's, quote, ability to reach the conscience of America would be his greatest contribution to the freedom struggles of the oppressed, end quote. Reverend Vivian points out that Dr. King actively challenged the church on many issues. On page 23, Vivian writes, his courage caused him to actively challenge all systems, first the church, then political systems, and finally economic systems. His demands for justice, freedom, and jobs led to his greatest victories. Those victories taught us to believe the human community could become whatever it chooses to become. He did it by teaching us to shape legislation from the streets, not just the suites. And I just want to go into the sermon context really quickly. I want to talk about the time in which this was written and delivered. So this sermon was written and was delivered in November of 1956. Okay. Dr. King had been leading the Montgomery bus boycott, a movement to end segregation in Montgomery, Alabama's public transit system, since the arrest of Rosa Parks on December 1st, 1955, for refusing to give up her seat on a bus. Just under 2 months later, in January of 1956, Dr. King's house would be firebombed with his wife, infant child, and a family friend inside. Immediately afterward, King addressed the vengeful armed crowd many of whom were members of his own congregation that gathered at his home seeking justice. He urged nonviolence. King says, "If you have weapons, take them home. If you do not have them, please do not seek to get them. We cannot solve this problem through retaliatory violence. We must meet violence with nonviolence." Remember the words of Jesus, "He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword." We must love our white brothers no matter what they do to us. We must make them know that we love them. Jesus still cries out in words that echo across the centuries, "Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you." This is what we must live by. We must meet hate with love. Remember, if I am stopped, this movement will not stop, because God is with the movement. Go home with this glowing faith and this radiant assurance." End quote. And as people continued the bus boycott, the year was marked with violence from white supremacist groups like the Ku Klux Klan and the White Citizens Council. Homes would be bombed, buses and private vehicles would be shot up, people would lose their jobs because of their participation in the boycotts. It goes on. And it is in this climate that Dr. King really leans into his message of nonviolent ideology and direct action. Segregation on Montgomery's public transit system would ultimately be deemed unconstitutional later that year by the Federal District Court in Alabama and upheld on appeal by the U.S. Supreme Court. The sermon that we discussed today, Paul's letter to American Christians, is first delivered at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery as Alabama and all of America awaits that U.S. Supreme Court decision. It is an imaginary letter as if from the Apostle Paul, written by Reverend King. It is inspired by the epistles of Paul, or letters of Paul, 13 books of the New Testament attributed to Paul the Apostle. Among these are some of the earliest Christian documents still in existence, giving light to the beliefs and controversies of early Christianity. And these texts make up a large portion of the New Testament canon and are therefore foundational to Christian theology and ethics. And it's important to put all of this into context, because as I urge people to be critical in thinking. And we are, in America, we've been very influenced by Christianity globally as well as locally. We're quoting the Bible like the Godfather, we don't even know how many sayings we use on a regular basis that are actually out of the Bible. And many of our leaders, we live in a Christian, to me, I think we live in a Christian fundamentalist government.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that we look at where people are coming from when they say God says this is right, God says this is wrong. Separation from church and state is really non-existent at this point. It's really blurred. So that's where we're at. And I wanted to make sure that I'm just not here reading Martin Luther King, "Everybody love each other," and then that's that. It's so much deeper.
It's so much deeper.
So welcome back to the conversation.
Hey, thank you for having me. Thank you for having me back.
So let's talk about some of your takeaways. Where do you want to start?
You know, I'm going to get there. I'm going to start over on the page 27, which is a little bit after the beginning, but I want to sum up this before we get to that point. Mm-hmm. One of the beautiful parts about this is, you ever hear that whole, not the forest for the trees, but the you can't see past the weeds, you know, you're just stuck in everything around you. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's the idea of bringing Paul from the past 2,000 years ago up to American Christianity now, because we believe that we're such a good Christian nation.
Mm-hmm.
But Paul comes up to say, hey, you know, you're blinded. You need to look much higher than where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
You need to look above all this because you're just in the weeds right now and you can't see what's going on. And so that'll bring me right over to on page 27. And he says, Paul says to, you know, the Christian churches here, well, obviously not, but he says, through your scientific genius, you have made of the world a neighborhood, but through your moral and spiritual genius, you have failed to make of it a brotherhood. And this kind of goes back to the last chapter that we read, you know, the moral failings or the values that we really hold on to. But I think this is really critical to it is like, you know, believe where you're at, but you know, the next line he says, keep your moral advances abreast with your scientific advances. Because
mm-hmm.
here we are, we're too focused on, you know, that we're right, you know, that it's just so all of our moral imperatives are based upon, you know, getting to the moon or fancy cars or, you know, all this infrastructure and roadways, but our moral values seem to have just gone by the wayside.
Yes, that was very much where we talked about last week, rediscovering lost values. And some of these are actual words from that previous sermon. One of the things from that that same paragraph, you have allowed the material means by which you live to outdistance the spiritual ends
mm-hmm.
for which you live. And I think it goes back to why are we here? You know, why do we even, what's the point?
Right.
If I'm just going to be
a consumer,
a slave to Elon Musk or just Jeff Bezos.
That was, you know, before we move on, that's another one a little bit later on, mm-hmm. just the next paragraph. You know, in quotations, everybody is doing it, so it must be all right.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, for so many of you, morality is merely a group consensus. And that's really what we're seeing, isn't it? You know, I mean, it's not really so much, I like to always call it like billionaire worship, mm-hmm. you know, or whatnot. But it's really that there's no one challenging them. And then they have all this money and therefore power. And so instead of challenging them, you know, we just kind of accept it and say that this is great and they're doing wonderful things because they earned it all,
mm.
you know? And we come up with all these words to justify, you know, our own enslavement, you know, our own abuse at their hands, you know, like here we are with a housing crisis, a food crisis and all this. The housing and food crisis doesn't hit these people, but yet we just go with it.
Mm. Well, it's they're the cause of it.
They are the cause of it.
So there is on page 28, King begins to talk about capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And through, I'm going to, about the middle of the paragraph, through this economic system, you've been able to do wonders. You have become the richest nation in the world, and you've built up the greatest system of production that history has ever known. All of this is marvelous, but Americans, there is the danger that you will misuse your capitalism. I still contend that money can be the root of all evil. It can cause one to live a life of gross materialism. I am afraid that many among you are more concerned about making a living than making a life.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I oddly enough, you know, one of the answers to it, just above that, but American Christians, I must say to you, as I said to the Roman Christians years ago, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. Do we do that as a society? I mean, you and I, we're working on our brain, but like as a society, are we renewing our mind? We're filling up with more action-packed garbage. You know, we're you know, desensitizing ourselves through, you know, and nullifying our senses through TV and things.
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons I feel pulled here to do this is because I want to massage out of the people who feel like that's no longer enough. Like, I think there was a point where the scales were tipped in American culture that people were content with the sitcom reality, right, trying to just make it even like latchkey people, like, who, you know, you're always hustling and your parents are hustling and, you know, you're watching shows and you're trying to make money. And that's just like the grind. I feel like lately there's what some people are calling a great awakening, you know, people coming more to consciousness, and that, like we were talking last week with bell hooks and the junk food analogy, that these things are no longer fulfilling. And I'm wondering if some people are also willingly trying to sabotage the system by voting for abnormal candidates, just doing like the Joker in Batman. Like, let's just toss the whole table over and see what happens, because we're all so fed up that we're just going to storm the Capitol and see what happens. Like, pandemonium has to be better than this disorder that we're living in.
Yeah, before it was very much, you know, what we do to get by. But now we're in a new era, and it's now what we do to overcome. And that's really all I see. You know, there's no more getting by anymore.
No, it's change or die.
Change or die.
I think that's pretty much the collective. We have that choice. That's all we can do, is change or die. Icky Mac and Dream Queen talking about A Knock at Midnight. Inspiration from the great sermons of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. I'm going to just a little bit more on that page. Dr. King writes, "The misuse of capitalism can also lead to tragic exploitation. This has so often happened in your nation. They tell me that 0.1% of the population controls more than 40% of the wealth. Oh, America, how often have you taken necessities from the masses to give luxuries to the classes?" And then at the bottom of that paragraph on page 29, he writes, "So I call upon you to bridge the gulf between abject poverty and superfluous wealth." I did a little digging last night on the wealth gap.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of information out there, a lot of different surveys, but it does look like 0.1% of our American population owns about $20 trillion.
Yeah.
And the ratio is about the same as it was in 1956.
Interesting.
And the lower 50% of our population controls 2.6% of the wealth.
Yeah.
Just 2%.
Crumbs.
And that lower 50% is the working class. And it's very frustrating to hear people say, "I work for my billions." What really, you worked really hard at colonizing, capitalized, like you slavery, basically, like, you know how to make people work and not pay them enough, or pay them in a way that the money goes right back into your pocket. You know, is that what you consider?
Or they had a $300,000 or $3 million investment that they had from, or $300 million that they were given, and they consider that work. But like, what's the working class have? Do we have some starting point like that?
Right.
No, I understand there's time when these billionaires went into the office and it wasn't on a yacht. I get that they, you know, put in a 2.6% effort, you know, to make billions and billions. You know, the other one that really bothers me the most, and this was one that I read recently, and I have not been able to confirm it because the numbers are weird, but someone, I don't remember which group it is right off the top of my head. I don't think it was Oxfam, but they went through and they looked at, you know, to end homelessness, houselessness in America, it would cost an estimated $20 billion. So like, one of these billionaires could do it without even flinching. They wouldn't even notice, and they could fix this problem. But why would they? Because it's a part of that whole, you learn it in business, you know, supply and demand, you know? So people who have not drive up that demand because they want, but they can't get. We need people who don't have, as far as capitalism goes, we need people who don't have in order to drive the cost up so that the billionaires can make more money. Because to them, it's a game. They don't realize that their billions of dollars represents lives lost. Mm. You know, to them, it's a numbers game. They just, they're just trying to prove who's got more.
Well, the thing is that when you're talking also, you know, because I think they do consider lives lost, but it's the value on the lives. So we have to not forget about colonialism, right, and what are the values on these lives. So I was telling you the other day about this movie I was watching about Haiti, this documentary. It's called 1804, the Forgotten History of Haiti. And it talks about Napoleon III, when faced with the slave revolts on the island, they decided on a mass extermination policy for genocide. After luring Toussaint Louverture to France and ambushing him and putting him in prison to starve to death, he was a decorated general, and he went to discuss ending slavery with the colony. And Napoleon was so angered by this, by his haughtiness, that he lured him there to talk on a premise to talk about a treaty, and threw him in prison where he starved. And much like King, he said, you know, I am just one part of this. This revolution is still happening. It's already, you can't stop it. And so Napoleon sends his soldiers over to Haiti and says, I want you to get every black general there, the 10 black generals, and bring them to me, and then exterminate all of the Africans on the island. And don't worry about it. There's plenty where they came from. So we're talking in the average life expectancy of an African on Haiti in 1801, say, was 3 to 7 years. So most of these people were directly shipped there from Africa, warriors, very thinkers, leaders, tribespeople, and they fought. And they went maroon. They lived off the land. But the point is that their lives were worth so little. And one of the arguments that I hear for proponents of the erasure of American history is this is all lies. Like, the slave masters wouldn't abuse their own property that way. They had to pay for, you know, that slave. And it's like, we're talking about making a point. We're talking about, you know, way more. It's not a logic. When you're talking about genocide, it's a factory kind of thing. So what I'm saying is that the bottom percentile of the workers on this planet, because it's no longer, things are all being made in America. I mean, I'm thinking about the kids in the mines, in the Congo, in Rwanda, in, you know, all of the mines that they are just shoveling people in and then dragging their bodies out.
Yeah. Have you heard what they call this for, you know, white America? They call those mines artisanal mining.
Oh, Jesus.
You know, it strikes this idea of, you know, oh, it's like a handmade loaf of bread.
No.
Right? No, it's not. It's very brutal and awful is what it really means whenever you hear that, people.
Well, geez, I don't even know where to go with this. There's so many places to go next. And this really leads into the part about the children of Ham. So if we're talking about segregation and the value of life, the peddling of flesh, as it were, that it's based on this idea that some are worth more than others, that God, you know, because a lot of the people who've been doing slavery consider themselves Christian. They are, people are saying this is the right and wrong argument, that these people did slavery throughout history, so it's not that bad. We weren't that bad. It, you know, those tribes enslaved each other, Native Americans enslaved each other, Europeans enslaved each other. What's so bad about chattel slavery in the United States, and it's slavery in the Bible. And Dr. King says on page 31 of A Knock at Midnight, "I understand that there are Christians among you who try to justify segregation on the basis of the Bible. They argue that the Negro is inferior by nature because of Noah's curse upon the children of Ham. Oh, my friends, that is blasphemy. This is against everything that the Christian religion stands for." And I was brought, the Children of Ham was brought to my attention in another documentary I was watching earlier this week. And I've heard that my whole life. And I Googled it last night, and I because I wanted to find a quick passage in the Bible where they were talking about Ham. And it's from Genesis 9. And Ham was a son of Noah, and Noah got drunk, and his son Ham walked in his tent and saw him there naked. That's the version that I'm seeing in my New American Standard Bible. And actually, I didn't read it in this Bible. I read it in another passage online. But there's scholars are so this is the thing about the Bible, you know, is one, it is the probably the most argued work in history. There are scholars going back and forth over every single passage in here for thousands of years since the time of Paul and all of them. So there's never any mention, but they all agree there's no mention of color in the Bible. So the idea was that God, Noah, you know, put a curse on Ham and said that all his sons were going to be servants of servants for seeing his nakedness. And that's one version of the story. And, you know, but what happened, Ham went outside and got his other two brothers, and they walked in backwards with a sheet and laid it over Noah. So those two sons didn't see their father naked. Huh. It's a very interesting passage, and I'm sure you can, you know, try to decipher it in many different ways. You know, we have to remember this, these texts have gone through so many different languages. But if you look on Wikipedia, you can really see a great outline of how the breakdown of how this story and how this passage was used to justify racial injustice throughout history. And we're talking about from Arabs enslaving dark-skinned Africans because of their translation into the Quran. We're talking about the English using those passages to be able to go and take people and justify it to each other just based on race. I encourage everyone to look it up because it's the cornerstone of why black people and people of darker skin are considered inferior in the eyes of God.
Because of Ham.
Because of the curse of Ham, which is not even real.
Right. This is a child of, it's not a different race than even.
Right. Well, they say that God made Ham's skin black as a punishment.
But not in the Bible. This is what people
were saying, is that the curse was that he was turned brown because of a translation. Wikipedia does a really good job. Whoever wrote that article did a really good job because it brought in the root words of the, you know, of a different version of the text, that one of the words could be translated as brown,
right?
But that is not the context. So these scholars are arguing this. I mean, I'm telling you, like, I mean, we're just two people sitting here, you know, trying to understand the world. And there's people whose whole jobs are to write articles for religious organizations to pull apart this Bible.
You know what that makes me really think about? Like, how I always wondered this. You know, like the one that, you know, the staunch Christians of America love to, you know, say all the time is what? That John 3:16, for God so loved the world.
Mm-hmm.
Does it say except the brown people? Does it say except for the black people? How is it people miss this? You know, God made the whole world. And he didn't say, I love the whole world, but hate these groups.
So right on, still on page 31, word, and thank you for bringing that in. And I did read the passages in the book of Acts, which is titled, you know, Acts is the Acts of the Disciples. But King says here, moreover, I must reiterate the words that I uttered on Mars Hill. God that made the world and all things therein hath made of one blood and all nations men for to dwell on all the face of the earth. And actually, really before that, I must say to you, as I have said to so many Christians before, that in Christ, quote, there is neither Jew nor Gentile. There is neither bond nor free. There is neither male nor female. For we are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you have this book, folks, you know, all you got to do is type in a search engine, a sentence, and then Bible. And it actually is like a lot of these words are just straight out of there.
Right.
And you can find the passages and read around them for context. And many of the apostles were straight up like, God created us all. That's the thing that got Jesus punished, right? Is that we are all children of God.
That's right.
That didn't really work for supremacy.
No, it did not. No, so they used other things to justify it, and they added context to Ham.
Yeah, and it's in it, you know, even in the translations. I mean, I'd love to, and I know it will come up because there are. I think I was reading in the book of Timothy last night, instructions to, if you are enslaved, to obey your master. And if your master is a follower of God, then that's all the better, basically, you know. But at the same time, we're not supposed to do violence to each other according to Jesus. And slavery is violence.
That's violence. Absolutely.
You're robbing somebody of a whole life and autonomy.
That's right.
And I contend that capitalism is wage slavery.
It is. I agree.
How many people have how much left at the end of the day? Can you stay ahead of your bills?
That's right.
Just trying to live.
Whew. Wow.
Yeah. It's a lot here. So I'm going to hit the ball back your way. What do you want to talk about?
You know, there's a passage that I had written down on page 32 to start with. And before I go into it, you know, I mean, obviously, we still have a racial problem in this country. I mean, obviously, it's not over just because some politician says it or whatever, right? There's still, and so you can see it in many different forms, like, you know, King's talking about segregation. And while legally it's not there, I mean, you can look around the communities, you know, are we really integrated yet? But I suddenly started thinking about this passage a little bit differently while we're talking about capitalism, when we're talking about, you know, these separations between us and them, you know, this wealthy class that is ruling over us, right? And I'm starting to think about it in terms of like, what if we were integrated into the wealthy society? I mean, not necessarily saying that we have to be like high society with our pinkies in the air and our fancy dresses at, you know, big galas, but what if we actually were in those same places? What if, you know, there wasn't this separation, you know, we didn't have a yacht and bodyguards, but we were actually like in the same place? What if all their children were forced to go to the same schools that all our children have to go to? You know, would this be able, because that's really the key of segregation, is removing empathy. You know, once we start like relating to each other, it's a lot harder to do these horrible things to each other. So, you know, in the time, they always have to keep the slave as someone who is ordained by God to be beneath them, someone who is less than human. And I would argue that that's what, you know, they think of us, right? What's that Ayn Rand, you know, we're just the useless eaters. Was that the quote?
Hmm. I don't read that Ayn Rand. Oh, I don't either. I heard too much. I was like,
I read a little bit. It's pretty gross.
Oh, like, no thanks.
It's pretty gross.
No eugenics for me.
So King on page 32 says, Christianity is diametrically opposed to the underlying philosophy of segregation and all the dialects of the logicians.
Thank where you. Are you?
Yeah. Logicans cannot make them lie down together. I'm book smart, but not like pronunciation dictionary smart. and all the dialects of all the logical people cannot make them lie down together. You know, and I guess I kind of want, let me like skip ahead because that, you know, those of you who are struggling against this evil, never succumb to the temptation of becoming bitter. Mm-hmm. See, that's the hard part, isn't it? Mm-hmm. While we're fighting for crumbs, while we're trying to look for where our next meal is, you know, we do have to keep love in our heart and we have to like love our enemy.
So the next line right there says, right after you said that,
yeah.
As you press on for justice, be sure to move with dignity and discipline, using only the weapon of love. Let no man pull you so low as to hate him. Yeah. Avoid violence. If you succumb to the temptation of using violence in your struggle, unborn generations will be the recipients of a long and desolate night of bitterness. And your chief legacy for the future will be an endless reign of meaningless chaos.
That's it.
That's it. Is wars? That's how we get endless wars.
Yeah.
And you know they take it all the way back to Genesis and Cain and Abel. Mm-hmm. You know, and so from that moment we are destined to be warring brother against brother. Is that the real original sin? Did they move that spotlight over to Eve and the apple because they didn't want to look at the toxicity of war and battle as being the original sin?
That's a beautiful question. That's a beautiful question. You know, that also, I want to say like that also, I mean, we'll look in the most obvious context right now is with the generations that people will suffer from that, you know? Just an innumerable large number of people who did not deserve it have died recently.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at one level, it's like, okay, well, have you gotten your revenge? Have you accomplished your mission? You have killed over 30,000 people. And they always say, but wait, but there was 1,200. And they'll never let us forget that there was this, you know, but they ruthlessly killed 3 people over here and 100 people over there. And so now we have to kill hundreds and hundreds of thousands.
They're not people. I could use a lot of derogatory terms to underscore what the brown people of the desert are considered by colonizing entities.
Right.
They are less than human to these people. Iggy Mag, I got to wrap it up. It went so fast.
That was quick.
It went so fast. Thank you for joining again, and I know you'll be back. I'm going to give it over to DJ Barnacle. We have to get out and clean up the studio. She's going to be in on 5 minutes. But I encourage everyone to take a look at A Knock at Midnight, inspiration from the great sermons of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. There are a lot of really good nuggets in this sermon, Paul's letter to American Christians. I'm just going to touch on 2 good points. Whenever you take a stand for truth and justice, you are liable for scorn, Dr. King writes. Mm-hmm. Often you will be called an impractical idealist or a dangerous radical. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it might mean going to jail. If such is the case, you must honorably grace jail with your presence. And sure. Another really quick one is King asks the question about the summum bonum of life. And I looked this up as the summum bonum is a Latin term originated by the Roman philosopher Cicero. And it's basically the highest good. And King argues that, as John says, and we covered last week, the Epistle John, God is love. And he who is participant in the being of, and he who loves is a participant in the being of God. He who hates does not know God.
Yeah.
So we're just going to keep coming back to this point, and we will try to find the meaning in a peaceful resistance, a joyful, peaceful resistance with dancing.
With dancing.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And I look forward to being with you next week. Keep an eye out for some updates on the YouTube channel in the Cab with Dream Queen. And we'll talk to you soon.